And I was just asking everyone if you can see them well enough. Because there is a microphone there that works with
you. Oh, there is?
Yeah, it's a little roving mic.
Oh, yeah. There's probably the acoustics in here aren't that bad, or a whole lot better than in that other place. Yeah. So, okay, well, you're all back. I take that as a sign of success. We knew he was leaving, so that's okay. I have lost rooms, during the break. So, believe it or not, I can be more out there in my talks than I have been today. So, but I was talking during the break about what we should talk about in the second part, and Chris mentioned that a lot of you are librarians and things like that. And I was, how many of you are from the library community? Okay, 3 or 4. Okay. So, okay, well, part of what I was thinking we might talk a little bit about, because, we are doing, the nature of knowledge, and I'm not going to start talking about neural networks and things like that, because although I have all kinds of theories along those lines, and if you push me, I will, so be careful. The other part of what I did promise to talk about was learning objects. And, there's a lot of interest in learning objects. And, of course, and I'm actually known, and this is one of these accidents that happens on the Internet, I'm actually known as one of the authorities on learning objects, and it really is quite the accident. I started working on what we call learning objects in about 95 or 96, and there weren't really learning objects then. And this is when I developed a learning management system for Assiniboine Community College, which is where I was working at the time. And what I was pushing at the time was that, I was back in the distance, I was young and naive, right? I was back in the mode of distance education where we would have a system that would present course material and give people a means of navigating through the course material. And back then, people were talking, well, okay, we'll put up websites and all of that. And I was saying, well, we should make it so that we can mix and match content and all of that. I called them modules. And I put all of this together in a paper called the Assiniboine Model, and actually coded it up in the form of a learning management system that we called OLE, Online Learning Environment, except the E was a little E, so it was OLE is what we called it. It was very cute, and then I realized that somebody else had actually used the name for something else, and I'd never get away with using it. Then I didn't get any funding to develop it or commercialize it, and so while Murray Goldberg, who developed WebCT in the same language, did the same thing at the same time, he became rich and famous, I became poor and impoverished. But I think I've had more fun, quite frankly. So when I went to the University of Alberta, early in my time there, I wrote a paper called Learning Objects. I don't know why I used it. I must have seen it somewhere in something I was reading. But I used the word learning objects and mapped out the theory of learning objects. And it just hit the right note. And, of course, has attracted a steady stream of criticism since then. That was a joke. Oh, nobody laughs at my jokes. I have, from time to time, thought about a career in stand-up comedy, but my experience as a speaker has convinced me that I have no future in stand-up comedy. Although I think I'd be pretty good at it. Yeah. Anyhow, that's way off topic. The idea of learning objects, and the idea of learning objects, right, is that you create a piece of content or whatever And when I was writing up this paper, I was more in the realm of whatever rather than the realm of content. Learning objects today have become, you know, pieces of content. You know, the official definition is something like digital resource used to support learning. But what people interpret that to mean is, you know, web page, you know, video, you know, flash animation, whatever. I was never thinking in those terms when I came up with my description of learning objects. I grew up in MUDs. How many of you are familiar with MUDs? All right, 3, 4, rock and roll. A MUD it stands for, variously, multi-user dungeon or multi-user domain. And I always use multi-user domain because it's really hard to convince your administrators that you want to build a multi-user dungeon. They sort of, you know, what are you up to, really? Now, MUDs are coded. They're the forerunners to CGI programs. So they run on a web server. They're typically written in C, which is a computer language. And one of the neat things about the way a MUD is designed is it creates an environment in which you can also write more code. So it's a two-level kind of thing. You have the base code. Now, I worked in a type of code called LP MUD. Named after a guy called Lars Pinsky or something like that. And so you log on to this MUD, you sign in, and then when you have the coding right, and you don't always have the coding rights right away, inside this environment, you can write more code that does things. And that's what I did. I didn't work so much on the base code or what they called a MUD lib. I worked an awful lot on the next level. And the way they set this up, and it's really cool, it's a neat idea, is that everything is what they call object-oriented. And those of you who are technologists are sort of now nodding, oh yeah, object-oriented design, right? But that's what it was. And what you would do is when you went to write the code for some part of the MUD, if you wanted to create a room, or if you wanted, you know, that people could go into, in and out of, or if you wanted to create a monster, I created lots of monsters. I became really good at coding monsters. And the tag that people came to know me for was numerous monks. Because you'd walk into a room, the little description says, what's in the room? And if you were in my area of the MUD, the description just simply said, numerous monks, because I made a mistake in the coding. And normally, a MUD, it'll create one or two or three or whatever monsters. Well, mine just kept creating them. And after a certain number of monsters, it just simply says, numerous. And so you walk into a room, there's virtually an unlimited number of monks in the room, some numerous monks. Anyhow, what you do is, you to create your program, you do what is called inheriting. And so what you do, the first line of your program is, inherit such and such. And what that does is, it connects your bit of code to a predefined object. So, and it's object all the way up. So like in a MUD, the way a MUD is organized, you have a basic object. And it'll be the sort of thing that does things that all objects have. All objects will have a name. All objects will have a location. All objects will have a creator, and so on. And now if you wanted to create a generic people object, you'd begin your code, right? Inherit object. So now what happens is all the capacities of the object are brought in to your generic people object. So if I want to make a monk, what I would do is inherit people. And I would inherit all the functionality from the people module, which in turn, remember, inherits all the functionality from the monk. Or sorry, from the object. I've got monks on the brain. Excuse me. And now, that's how object-oriented coding works. And there are two major things. There's more, but there's two major things that happen in these objects. an object, strictly speaking, is basically a space in memory that has a set of values. So, for example, if I create a generic person, what I'm doing is creating a space in memory that I'll have a spot for the person's name, the person's age, the person's current location, so on and so forth, all the variables, right? And what happens is, when I want to create a new instance of this, what I'll do is, it's called cloning. I'll clone a person object. And strictly speaking, what's happening here is the computer program, the C computer program that's running all of this, looks at the original, checks and sees what that is, and says, okay, now I'm going to allocate a certain bit of memory over here for an exact copy of that. And now that's the one that we're going to work with. The other thing, and this is the cool thing about object-oriented programming, is in addition to variables in these objects, I can build in functions. So if I have a typical person object, I can give that person the capacity, say, to move. And you know, in programming, you have to define everything. So if I'm creating a person, I need to, you know, if the player types, you know, west, right, and in MUD you type west, your person character goes west. You write that up as a function. So the idea is, in the generic person object, I have a move function defined. So when I clone that, and now I've cloned it, and I'm going to start adding details to it, like the dress of the monk, the name of the monk, the starting location of the monk, but I've also inherited the function of that monk, so that I can, for example, my specific monk, I can write another little function that'll cause it to move randomly. What it'll do is it'll access each of these predefined functions. Now that is what, way back in the beginning, people thought were learning objects. We're nowhere near that now, are we? I mean, you don't inherit things with a macromedia flash file or anything like that. We've gone so far away from that original vision. I talked a bit before the break about things like learning environments and things like that. This is my MUD heritage coming out, because you can populate an environment, which is what a MUD is, with these objects, and the objects in turn inherit different types of functionality. And there's virtually no limit, there is no limit, to the type of objects that you can create in these sorts of environments. I talked about creating monsters and things like that. I coded all kinds of things. I code a bulletin board. A bulletin board is just a type of object. Has certain functions available to it. What else? I coded books. I coded a lecture theater with a podium, with doors so we could keep the people out or in, as whatever was required. One of the things that I did, it was in 1996, myself and a colleague, Jeff McLaughlin, who's at the University College of the Caribou, we got together and we created a fully online conference in a MUD environment that we called MOD, Multiple Academic User Domain. And we hosted this for the Canadian Association of Distance Educators. And it's still out there. The code is still there. All the sessions are recorded. We had breakout rooms. We had speaker lists. We had the lecture theater. It's all text-based because yeah, it's 1995 or 96, I forget which year, but it was all done in this world of MUDs. So I'm thinking all of this when I'm writing my paper called Learning Objects. I'm trying to explain this, and if we had things like these objects that we could pull down out of the ether from wherever and then customize or do whatever we wanted for our particular educational application, we'd save ourselves piles of cash, piles of programming time. In the world of MUDs, it's the only way to program. Nobody would create a person object from scratch. There's utterly no need to do it, because everything you need in a person object is there in the person object. It didn't work out that way. I don't know why. Well, I kind of know why it didn't work out that way. And, you know, this is my paranoia and conspiracy theory. It's really hard for publishers of traditional academic material to make a profit on this model. So learning objects became content. And all of the discussion of learning objects shifted to discussion of things like learning object metadata. Now, you've all heard of learning object metadata, right? You must have. Right. Horrible, horrible thing. But again, I was once young and naive and believed in this stuff. And in my learning object paper, I actually did talk about learning object metadata because in a MUD's a nice closed environment, everything's there. But in an open, distributed environment, which is what this whole e-learning thing was supposed to be, again, back, way back when we thought it would be very different from what it was, the big problem with learning objects was finding them, because there could be all kinds of objects. Even in a MUD, it was a bit tricky, you know, trying to find a particular monk. It's just, man, you know, you have to set up your search so that you know that you're searching for a monk, and you know you're searching for this monk, and it's the monk that was born in this room, and whatever. And the same sort of thing happens with learning objects. One principle of learning objects is reusability. And of course, if they're objects, they're automatically reusable. That really transmogrified once learning objects stopped being objects and became being bits of content. But the other thing that's a major criterion for learning objects is that they be discoverable. Now, you have the mental picture in your mind, right? And the way it works, so you have an instructional designer. The instructional designer is preparing some prepackaged content. You know, it's you know, the publishing world, so it's probably going to get slapped onto a CD-ROM or something like that. But they're working in their design environment, IDE, what do they call that? Interactive Design Environment. Kind of like one of these programs that you use to create programs. And I actually use them. When I wrote programs in Turbo C, I would actually start up a programming environment and all the pre-arranged bits of code there would be available for me. I don't do that anymore. I write all my code in Notepad now. It's much easier. And so you're working in one of these environments. It's a learning object authoring environment, and you need to be able to find the learning objects that you're going to bring into your bit of instruction. So the idea is that your environment will tap into a search system of some sort, but it's got to be better than Google, right? Because if you're creating a piece of learning content and you want to put in, say, a picture of a horse, and you go to search for a picture of a horse and you get 20 million results, this is not useful. You haven't really narrowed the scope here at all. So the idea of metadata was to facilitate what they call faceted searches. That is to say, we have a particular resource and we describe this resource along a number of parameters, or if you will, a number of vectors. And then the search that we undertake for the resource can match these particular parameters specifically. So, for example, if I'm searching for a photo of a horse, I don't just type in horse, because then I'll get a website about horses. I'll get Horse the movie, you know, Black Beauty, whatever. So I tell the search engine, I'm searching for a photo, and I want the photo to be in color. I want it to be of the subject horse. I want it to be a certain size. And now, and if you get into the world of learning objects, we now start adding educational metadata. So, you know, I mean, maybe I want, you know, all about horses or something like that. So I want it for a certain age range. I want what they call the semantic density, you know, or the level of instruction or the level of content to be whatever. So that was the theory. We'll take these objects, we'll describe these objects as precisely as possible, and then that will facilitate these faceted searches that these people in the instructional design sweatshops can use to quickly bring in this stuff and get that learning material pumped out and stamped on the CD. Because, of course, it was all about CDs by now, which is so utterly horribly wrong. So This all began with the AICC, Aviation Industry something something, I forget off the top of my head, which morphed into the Instructional Management System metadata protocols, and they came up with their 87 or whatever fields to describe a learning resource, and this became IEEE LOM, which was the standard, and still is the standard, IEEE LOM, IEEE Learning Object Metadata. And then you take this standard and you fashion it for a particular use. In Canada, we got what is called CANCOR. CANCOR just is a way of looking at IEEE LOM. IEEE LOM tells you what all the different fields are, the 87 fields or so. CANCOR will say what the different values of those fields can be. So IEEE LOM is the vocabulary. CANCOR, which is known as an application profile, is the specific words or the specific meaning that can be that vocabulary can have. The other application profile that everyone's familiar with, I'm sure, or at least you've heard it in passing, usually accompanied by swear words, SCORM. SCORM, shareable, and now Dan Rehak's boasting about changing the meaning of the acronym like that was a good thing. Shareable courseware, or now shareable content object reference models. You know, object's still in there because it has this history. And people like Wayne Hodgins and Dan Rehak and people like that still have these objects in the back of their mind. And all the people at Cisco, where a lot of this stuff came from, they're thinking objects of. They haven't given up on it, but it's just so changed. So we have SCORM. And enter the world of librarians, because now we have 87 fields. And we're exhausted, right? Because for this system to work, there have to be quite literally millions of learning objects. In fact, in my newsletter a month or so ago, I actually ran some numbers, and I forget, you know, Microsoft has like a million objects in their repository, and Cisco has 1.4 million objects in their repository. You sort of sit there and think, how on earth did these things get tagged? And I'm looking at metadata, and like, 87 tags, and yet they're insufficient. It just kills me. As you look at now, I don't know if you guys have memorized the IMS or the IEEE tags. I haven't memorized them, and I won't memorize them. But I know my way around the backyard here, right? Things like technical format. Now, if you actually try to use technical format will not produce any information that your computer or your computer program that's using this learning object can actually use in order to understand what to do with it. Or, rights. There's a section of IEEE LOM called rights. It consists of three fields. I forget what they are exactly, but it's something along the lines of permission required, that's not the exact name, but cost, and then description. The first two are yes, no, binary tags, right? Permission required, yes, no. Cost, yes, no. No place to actually put the cost. And then the third, which is description, which is what's called a language string, and what that means is you type it out, whatever it happens to be. Useless. You can't use this. And the metadata has lots of stuff like, you know, the creator of the learning object and the publisher of the learning object and all the usual bibliographical stuff. Now, this is what kills me. If you guys are in, those of you who are in library sciences, you are also familiar with a metadata language, and I'm quite sure that you'll have heard of this. Dublin Core, right? Now, if you take Dublin Core, and if you take IMS metadata, put them up side by side, see a huge degree of overlap. Like, they both assign titles to the name of whatever. So I'm sort of sitting here thinking, well, what's going on here? Why did they put all of this stuff in the learning object metadata? Makes no sense to me. So I thought about this. And I thought about, what are we really trying to do with this stuff? Well, like, I haven't even talked about the nature of learning objects and the granularity and all of that stuff, because remember, I'm in the object world. I still think that if we did this right, these could be neat little bits, snippets of software that would do stuff for us. But leave all that aside. I mean, we're still at the point in this world where we're still messing around with the metadata and the description. So I'll stay in that world for a little bit. Although, I have never abandoned the other thing. And I won't abandon the other thing. I'm going to come back to that. Remind me to come back to that. Right at the very end, I'm just going to do a real quick little display that'll show what it should be. So, see if I can't find that slide. See, I was thinking about this, and I thought, okay, what's the dominant metaphor for learning object metadata? Well, I can only blame myself, because I came up with it. I believe I came up with it first, but it's been repeated over and over and over again, so, you know, the true provenance of this is probably lost. But the dominant metaphor of metadata is the label on a can of soup, all right? And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense, right? Because it's a good model, right? Because the object is like the slushy stuff on the inside. And then the label on the can of soup is what tells you about the slushy stuff on the inside, right? So it's a big sign, it's soup, you know, distinguishes it from string beans. And then, you know, the publisher's name, Campbell's. And then some of the objects that are inside, you know, monosodium glutamate, you know, mushrooms, da-da-da-da-da. You know, you get the idea, right? I was thinking, and that's how we learn about cans of soup. And that's, indeed, when we go to a grocery store, and in a grocery store, there are quite literally millions of eating objects, and we need to do a directed search and retrieval of those objects that we call this shopping. And the only way we're able to get at what the content of those cans are and get the correct can is by looking at the label. That's the mechanism. Works pretty well. But it's not all soup, is it? If we look at the wide and wonderful world of content generally, or even software, because remember, I still have my original picture of objects, which I haven't given up on, and I won't give up on it. I wonder if this thing's still recording. Ah, yeah, we're still away from races. Okay. So it's just, it stopped at 27 minutes in Canberra, so now I'm all paranoid about it. Think about how you decide what movie you're going to see, or what book you're going to buy. That might be a less good example. How you decide what piece of software you're going to install on your computer. Now, all of these things have metadata, right? Librarians know this. You deal with video and books, of course, you know, right? So you have information about these things. You have the title of the book or the movie or the author or the publisher, da 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 da. Now, is that the only information you use when deciding to install, say, a piece of software or read a book? Of course not. And here's the killer question. If you were making a purchasing decision about just about anything, would you rely completely and solely on the description of that object provided by the manufacturer of that object? Well, no. Nobody would. In fact, that would be insane. Well, maybe not insane, but it would be really stupid because they lie. they just outright blatantly lie. And it's well documented. HTML, when HTML was invented and everybody was young and naive and idealistic, they put tags in the header of HTML and they were called meta tags. And they need to have meta keyword equals, right? And so the porn site, you know, you have this porn site, really awful stuff. You have meta keyword equals educational nature.
Walt Disney.
Yeah, popular one. So. Yeah, they lie, and it's not just the porn sites that lie. You look at the marketing by publishers or movie houses or things like that. No, you don't just listen to the publisher, because that would be stupid. You get a second opinion, you get a third opinion. In the wonderful world of movies, we have things called movie reviewers, who are more or less independent, unless they're fictional entities created by the movie studios, which has also happened. But the idea here is that you get a third party reviewing the particular learning or the particular media entity in question. Even soup. You ask your friend, did you try that? Yeah, how'd you like it? Well, it was lumpy. Oh, I don't want that. You know. You get opinions of other people that are not the manufacturers of the metadata. So, there's something seriously, fundamentally wrong about the picture of metadata as being the label on the side of a soup can, if, in fact, metadata is the mechanism that we want to use in order to search for and retrieve learning content. Clearly, obviously, we have to have what I call third-party information in metadata. So I thought about this, and last year I wrote a paper called Resource Profiles, which was, as an aside, almost completely ignored by the community. I don't want to plug the paper too much, but Resource Profiles is an important paper. It's a very technical paper. It's a hard paper. It's a long paper. But if I can find the slide, I can give it to you in one slide. Not bad, eh? I just have to find it. And it's here somewhere. This is the slideshow I was going to do, but... where? There we go. So let's take the idea of metadata and completely break it apart. And forget about the soup can, the description of content. I started thinking about the kind of things that we want to do when we describe resources. And what I did is I broke metadata apart into three types of metadata. And as you can see here, and so long as I'm not standing in front of the screen, I've got first-person metadata, second-person metadata, and third-person metadata. And I thought that was neat because 1, 2, 3, who can go wrong with that? First-person metadata is information about the resource that we would expect to be created by the people who created the resource. Things like the name of the resource. Things like what kind of resource it is. Things like what the rights are that would be attached to this resource. That's your traditional metadata. But most metadata, this is very small. In fact, and this is part of the Resource Profiles paper too, this could be done almost completely, and in fact I would say completely, in Dublin Core. And what I recommended in my paper was throw out all of that part of IEEE LOM. Why are you creating a separate incompatible system of recording bibliographic information when we have the much more widely used Dublin Core? So throw out that part, or at least create a binding or something like that, and basically use Dublin Core for the first-person metadata. Now, the third-person metadata is what I was just talking about. And there are two major categories of this: evaluation and classification. evaluation metadata, and the simple example I use is it's a one tag, and it has two possible values, right? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Very simple. Now, of course, you can come up with more complex evaluation metadata schemas, and in a project that we did at NRC for a company called, Mosaic, who then became Knowledge Pool, who then shut down their operations in Canada because they got bought out. Oh, I love this industry. We created actually a multi-layered schema for evaluation metadata across various educational criteria. If you go out and you look at the world of evaluating learning objects, you'll find some fairly standard things. Well, one of the things that we hit that really flummoxed us for a little bit was different types of evaluation apply to different types of objects. You would evaluate a photograph by very different criteria than you would evaluate a piece of text or a piece of video. And so what we had to do for evaluation actually was a tree kind of thing. So you'd have some things in common, but then as you got more precise about the type of object that it was, you had to be more precise about the type of evaluation that you were doing. And since most evaluators want to do nothing more than thumbs up, thumbs down, or as you've seen on the web maybe, whether it's hot or not, we actually came up with a mechanism whereby you could drill down if you wanted, or you could just do the thumbs up, thumbs down. Classification, the domain of librarians, is another example of third-party metadata. And those of you who are librarians will laugh along with me when we think about the authors of learning content correctly classifying their own material. Thank you for the laugh. Classification systems are typically designed by and applied by experts, and there are very good reasons for that. There are numerous classification systems. You're familiar with them, Library of Congress, Dewey Decimal, whatever, and various domains of inquiry, physics, chemistry, so on, have their own detailed classification system. So again, in resource profiles, they talk a lot about how we don't just have one classification system for everything, but how this needs to be a mechanism whereby we're picking the classification system as well as the particular value within that system. And that has sort of appeared in IEEE LOM, and IEEE LOM does actually support a source or catalog and then value or entry fields in the learning object metadata, so you can actually classify according to different catalogs. That's good. Something they did right. What's really neat now, and the part that's almost completely untapped, is what I call second-person metadata. Second-person metadata is where we get to the heart of IEEE LOM, and it's fascinating to me that on reflection, they thought the authors of the learning object would get this and provide this metadata. Now, what's second party or second person metadata? I don't know why a person, because I always think of third party metadata, so my own terminological regime is confused. But second person metadata is, in the end, metadata about how the learning resource is used. And so you get the typical educational metadata schemas. The educational level, any sequencing that you're doing, for example. One of the IEEE LOM fields is interaction level, which is the very usefully, 0 to 10. It's pretty useless, actually, but anyhow, there it is. But the idea here is you are describing, in this part of the metadata, the educational role of the object. Now, you might ask, why do I say that that's second-person metadata? Well, because the definition of learning objects that I use, and you notice now we're well into the talk, and I'm finally going to define learning objects. The definition of learning objects is something that is used for learning. A very circular definition, and being a philosopher, I can get away with that. But the point here is, something becomes a learning object if and only if it is used in learning. And it acquires the properties inherent in being an educational object by being used in learning. Like, for example, this pack of matches was not a learning object up until 1 second ago. It is now a learning object. It is being used in learning. It now has educational properties. It is playing the specific role of example of a learning object. Its place in the sequence of this talk is within the context of a definition of learning objects. It had none of these properties until it was used. And now the kicker is, if the person who made the matches were writing up a label for these matches, it is very unlikely they would have put to be used as an example of learning object. Wouldn't happen. Now, most learning objects are like that. The designer of the object has an idea, maybe, of how the thing might be used, maybe not. And if we define learning objects widely enough as videos, as pictures, things like that, people don't know how a picture is going to be used. Once it's used in the context of learning, we now have a single case, a single instance of this object being used in this way. It now has acquired data related to its use. And so now we start accumulating it. And we really should be tracking this, trying to understand how the object was used in the course of its lifespan. And so in my paper I talk about the lifespan of learning. Learning objects are a lot like people, you think about it. Person is born, not very much metadata, right? Gee, they don't even have a name when they're born. But let's suppose, well, they have a last name. Well, usually. Right? So, right? But, you know, they'll have a name, they'll have a location, and that's almost about it. Right? Because a lot of what we know about a person doesn't come into existence till the person starts acting and interacting in the world. And as time goes by, we learn more about this person. We start accumulating information about this person. The person might get a criminal record. They might get a high school degree. All of this is second person metadata. It's stuff that comes up as a consequence of use, in this case, of the person of themselves. Same thing for a learning object. Learning object has this lifespan, and as it gets used, we come to see that it can be used here, it can be used here, it can be used here, it can be used here. And that's what gives us the data, the information that should go here in this second-party metadata. Well, this is a completely different picture of learning object metadata than the one that they're pushing at IEEE LOM and at ADL with SCORM and so on and so forth. Because the model that they're talking about there, you have one author. And the one author of the metadata that you have to listen to is the person who actually created the learning object. And when you think about the fact that the marketplace that they're trying to set up is mostly a commercial marketplace, you begin to realize that the current approach to metadata as being promoted by IEEE LOM and so on is one that very much favors the vendors and very much doesn't favor other people. So there's an issue here. Now it's a little after 12, so we're kind of closing out this morning's session, so I don't want to go late, although I already have, obviously. But there's an awful lot of talk about the design and the organization of things like learning object repositories and stuff like that. You've probably seen that. And I'll preface by saying I love the people at EDNA. They are incredibly talented, incredibly smart, know a lot of stuff. But when they talk about something like federated searching, and you watch for that phrase, there should be a flag. If they talk about federated searching, almost by definition, federated searching allows for the searching of learning resources only by first-person metadata. Because in a federated search, you, the searcher, conduct a search across repositories in real time. That means the metadata never leaves the publisher's house. The publisher has full, complete, and constant control of the metadata. So the only metadata you ever get when you do a federated search comes from the publisher. And it is, in fact, not possible to attach second and third party metadata to it. Can't be done. So when the people at EDNA, and I will be going to Adelaide in a week or 2 weeks or whatever, when they talk about federated search, I would push back and say, well, how are we going to do evaluation metadata on these objects if the only metadata available is in the provider's repository? How are we going to track the context of use of these objects if there's no way to put data into the provider's repository? So there is and is going to be an increasing tension here, and there's going to be a push back and forth between this closed, commercial, we tell you all federated model of searching and something like the grocery store, where we have free and open access to not only the contents of the can, but also what people thought about the contents of the can and the recipes that the can was used in. And we'll close off my morning talk with that. I'm sorry there weren't time for questions, but if you're here this afternoon, oh, I hope you're here, I'll make it more interactive and we'll talk a lot more. So that's it for now.
You were going to show us what you did.
Right.
You have a bit more time.
Oh, I do?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was, like, late.
No, it's probably
20
minutes early.
Oh, 20 minutes early, for God's sake. The people on the tape are probably just killing themselves now. Yeah, okay. It was a great talk, for the talk that I had.
Yeah.
I was pretty pleased with it. Well, I never know how these are going to come out, you know. Particularly when I'm working without notes, and I just know what I want to do, but vaguely. All right. Yeah. Okay, rock and roll. I even have Internet Explorer, so this will actually be the good version of it. Doesn't work completely in Firefox. It's an issue that some people are having with the developers of Firefox, anyhow. Right. Let's go back to what learning objects should be. And let's even pretend for a moment that learning objects are content, because that's a place we're comfortable with. Now, I mentioned earlier that all the talk, and it is, it's all the talk in IMS, IEEE, ADL, EDNA, da-da-da-da-da-da, is on metadata, and more recently on specifications for distributed repositories, or it's called IMSDRI, and it's the definition of federated searching, but we'll leave that aside because I've already slammed that. And learning design, which is a whole other kettle of fish, which I won't get into at the moment, although I have many thoughts on that. You know what's missing in all of these specifications? Nowhere in AICC, SCORM, CANCOR, whatever, do you actually have a definition or, you know, a specification of what a learning object is. And, you know, you have these drag 'em out fights, you know, define a learning object. I'm not talking about that. I mean, in Toronto, I held up a tissue paper and said, that's a learning object. And there was nothing in all of the standards that could say I'm wrong. And in fact, I wasn't wrong, because, of course, it acquired learning properties once I used it as an example. But what we've got here, I mean, these things are supposed to be reusable. They're supposed to be like objects. You pull them out of the ether, you customize, right? Harvest, repurpose, remix, feed forward, right? We got Harvest, kind of. Repurposed, Remix, yeah, if you have the right software. Feed forward, sure, if you got full reprint rights and licensing and things like that. But there's no common method to do this. Now, I got a call, actually an email, because I don't answer my phone. I got an email from the people at Canadian Forces Base Gagetown. And, you know, there's Canadian Forces, they work hand in hand with ADL and SCORM and all of that. Just as an aside, because those of you who are familiar with SCORM are probably thinking SCORM, United States, right? SCORM was actually invented by Canadians. In the Canadian Forces, it is a Canadian invention. It was created by Captain Peter Hope and is it Major? Colonel? Something. Roger St. Pierre. And they set it up and then they took it down to the U.S. military and the U.S. military said, good mic! Like they do. An awful lot of e-learning has gone through that cycle where it gets developed in the regions and then it becomes an American invention. But I'll leave that a little bit aside. So I got this call from Jeremy, who works at the Forces Base down the road from me. He says, you know, we've got some things here. We've got an application that creates learning objects, and we've got a SCORM tagger, and we're going to put them together, but that's okay. And we've got a learning object player, a viewer for learning objects. But the problem is, the viewer for learning objects was created in Flash. We can't get at it to change the code. The people who created the Flash say that, you know, they want royalties and all of that. We've got this content we can create, but we can't use it. So, I looked at what they had done. I wonder if there is Flash on this machine or not to me. So, let's see if I can't find it here. Right. So this is what he sent me. Is this it? Oh, come on. Sorry, I just have to check the... this isn't it. Original XML file. Sorry about this. I know I'm pretty sure it's here. Not that it matters. I make the same point without it. It's just I can't read and give a talk at the same time. No, that should be it. But it isn't. HTML plus Flash. Yeah, okay, come on, mouse. Jeez. Yeah, this is it. Yeah, okay, this is it. Good. And now my mouse is frozen again. Dell, I should have known. I should have known. Probably single source purchasing agreements, the bane of existence. So this is it. Now, you'd probably like to see it. There it is. Okay. You know, we'll forget the fact that we got highly sensitive military information now being shown. Sure. Actually, I checked with them about this, so I'm able to show it to people. No problem. Covered those bases. So, well, yeah, what do you do? It's a piece of Flash, right? We can, you know, it's a page turner. it can, you know, and it does stuff. So on and so forth. There it is, right? Now, this is pretty typical. I've looked at lots and lots and lots of learning objects. And some are more animated, some are less animated. This is like run-of-the-mill, you know, wouldn't stand out in the crowd, your typical learning object. And it's made of Flash, which means they can't change it. You can't change the picture. They can't change the text, so on and so forth. Now, what Jeremy said is, can you fix this for me? Now, I wonder if this... So what I did, the neat thing about Jeremy's application is that it produces its output in the form of XML. Now, XML is wonderful. Do all kinds of things. So let me, I'm just going to, come on. Oh, there we go. Oh, it's going to give me, Internet Explorer is so stupid. Okay. So there's the original content that his application produces. It's kind of hard to read because it doesn't have nice indents. I talked all about that. It still doesn't have nice indents in it. This is XML. The idea of XML is that it's plain text. As you can see, I can open it up in Notepad. So I can change any of this. And then the structure of a learning object is defined in what should be standard XML. So if you look carefully and with X-ray vision, you can see in here, let's see if we can't find something. It's so hard to read this. It doesn't help if the mouse freezes. SCO subtitle. I'm looking for SCO page or SCO section or so on and so forth. And I just can't find it here. It's here somewhere. It should be down here. SCO pop-ups, all kinds of stuff. Anyhow, it has sections, and in each section there are pages, and then in each page there are paragraphs, and the system has spots for the multimedia, it's got spots for the audio and all of that, right? Now, I'm not saying that this could or should be the standard XML description for learning objects. And in fact, I was talking with David Wiley about this when I was in Utah, and he was saying there's a slightly different thing that is coming out called, I think it's Connectrix or Connections or something like that. If you look up on his website, David Wiley's website, he actually put a link to it in one of his items just a few days ago. So I'm going to run it in my newsletter as soon as I remember to do that. It's been on my brain for like 2 weeks. Still hasn't appeared in my newsletter. So there is the base. And then on top of that, now what I did with that is this. Now, this is not exactly the same as the Flash. And part of the reason why it's not exactly the same as the Flash is because once I'd proved the concept, I kind of stopped coding. But it's pretty close. And it's got all the functionality, right? All the stuff. Now, what this is XML as your base content, and then what I've done is I've processed this XML file with an XSL transformation called XSLT. Now, all an XSLT does, and if I can find it, here it is. Here's an example of it. All an XSLT file does is it runs through an XML file and it looks for different tags, and when it sees a tag, it replaces it with whatever the XSLT file says. So, for example, an XSLT file might say, run through the file, and every place you find page, put a page header. Things like that. So that's pretty nifty. So what I did is I defined the XSLT to convert this XML file that they're showing in Flash to show this in XML. But being even more sneaky and devious than that, and because I needed to do a little bit more than just render it into HTML, I also used the XSL to call an external style sheet, a CSS style sheet, and there it is. Who knows what we're going to get with Internet Explorer. And if Dreamweaver. Good technology should do what you want it to do, and opening Dreamweaver was not it. But we can actually see, and for some reason it was open to the bottom of the small sheet. Meanwhile, the mouse is frozen. There we go. Anyhow, that's actually, I used two separate style sheets for various reasons. And then the other thing, because I'm really sneaky, who knows what Internet Explorer is going to do? Oh, what would you like to do? Let's open it. He's not going to know what to do. He'll ask me to open this in. Oh, Dreamweaver again. Yeah, Dreamweaver, your one-stop JavaScript application. I also had it install JavaScript. So now I've got four things on the go, right? The original XML, the XSL transformation, the cascading style sheet, and the JavaScript. Now, this is real modular. But what's important here is I can now start treating any of these four elements as though they were objects on that original model. See, the author of the learning content publishes this XML. Once this XML is out there, now it will inherit or use a standard XSL. And you can have different XSLs, but what I would recommend, and will recommend, because I haven't written the paper yet, but just put a standard one out there, right? Learning Object SSL 1.0. And it'll handle the transforms for you. And it'll call the CSS and the JavaScript. And the idea is, when it calls the CSS and the JavaScript, instead of calling those from some centralized location, it'll call it from a local location. So your localization, all the look and the feel, plus a lot of the action, the mechanisms, what the thing actually does, that's all defined locally. So you put the CSS and the JavaScript on your server. You access this XML from wherever it happens to be. Right? You don't even need to move it. You certainly don't need to put it on CD-ROM. It's just wherever it is. You access the XML. The XML calls the style sheet. The style sheet refers to the local CSS. You've got a localized learning object, which you can have with locally defined functions. And this would include interaction with your learning management system, if that's what you like. Me, I don't care, but some people are really big on that. Or things like your JavaScript can pick up the student profile, use the student profile, apply it in to the CSS for the rendering of this object in, say, a given language, or, you know, in big text or whatever. The JavaScript plus the XML plus the user information can be used as a point of access into a discussion board. Whatever. The point is, it's small pieces. It's distributed. It's very loosely connected. All right? It's hardly connected at all. But it gives you that capacity that you're looking for in learning objects in the first place. Now here's the rub. Nobody's going to make money on this. This is low tech. This I did all of this in Notepad, or more accurately, Notes Tab, which is a slightly better version of Notepad. Very low tech. Anybody can do this. It's easy to write software that would do this for you. And the application that Jeremy created, unfortunately, I had it all worked out. It was going to be, the application was going to be open source. All of this was going to be open source. But I got an email, sorry, can't open source the app. There's a developer back there somewhere who did part of it who won't release his three lines of code. So it's got to be written from scratch. I will make sure it gets written from scratch. I don't know how, I don't know with what, but I will make sure it gets written from scratch. But anyhow, the application is there. It's a, you know, like a 50K desktop install. Works like a charm. In fact, if we have time after, even now, I'll fire it up and you have a quick peek at it. This kills commercial publishing. So there's no real push, no real incentive on the part of, you know, Microsoft and Thomson Publishing or anything like that to make sure that there's actually some kind of definition as to what a learning object should be. But there should be. Because once we have that XSL, and once we have that shared common idea of what the parts of a learning object are, we're off to the races. We can go back to the picture of learning objects as they were supposed to be. Not some kind of private repository of publisher content that they will charge us an annual license in order to just look at the metadata, but something that can be created on the fly by instructors, by students, by people working in wherever they work, whatever. Something that can be shared dynamically, something that can be dramatically localized, and something that really does be, you know, something that can be described and used, evaluated, entered into as data points in a massively distributed social network, and with all the implications of that. In other words, we can have an open learning object economy, and all we need to pull it off, and it just kills me, and this isn't it, all we need to pull it off is this. So simple. And yet, companies with billions of dollars, multiple governments, entire military organizations haven't given us that. This is why I get paranoid. So anyhow, this is what's coming down the pipe. And, you know, this is the Linux of educational content. If it's not exactly this, it'll be something like this. If it's not the tool I have on my laptop now, it'll be something like the tool on my laptop now. It's going to happen. So, you know, I was advising people earlier, you know, don't bet the farm on learning management systems and things like that. That's why. This is not next generation e-learning as envisioned by SCORM and by EDUCAUSE and all of them. It's the major publishers with their common services and things like that. This is a people's e-learning, something that anybody can do. It's learning almost the way it was. I'm just reducing things now. I hope firing this up doesn't kill the sound, but we'll see. I also have to find it. There's the SCORM metadata creator. My eyes are so terrible, so it's really hard. If you see it there, tell me. Putty, TempXML. I know it's on here. I know it's here. Power MP3 recorder. Do you love this stuff? I went to Telstra to get Big Pond because I'm here for a month, and they said, no, it won't install any software on your computer. I mean, what kills me is I stood there at the counter. This is in camera. I stood there at the Telstra counter and said, "You're lying to me." They kept up with it. Has anyone found it? This is the MP3 recorder.
Okay, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for, I forget what it's called, but it's it's the tool that creates the learning object that I just described. Let's just do this in order. Conquest. You can see all my video games. Oh, man, I'm just so bad at this. Knowledge Warrior, that's not it, no. There it is. Alright, firing this up. And it being in Windows, it's going to take a few seconds to actually start up. Linux. You can tell, right? This is forces based. You try to tell them, right? You're going to have to change this. So, let's create a new learning object. And so, here it is. Module title. Steven Zello. Section title. Section 1. Caps lock, whatever. And I think it'll let me go without that. And select school, that's what they do. That actually sets a few parameters inside. And now I'm into editing my learning object. And insert, GP after, and now it's going to add some stuff for me. Alright, and here's a page. And insert, page after, I'll add another page. And I'll go into this page. There's the main paragraph. So on. And then save it up. Save hello as. And they give me the standard save screen. And I've created my learning object. I said in Canberra, and I'll say it here again, we need a blogger of learning objects. Because what's supposed to happen is this tool combines with the other tool, and this is the one that says SCORM in the title here, wherever it is. Pardon?
Up 2 lines and 2
minutes. Whee! Well, the beta version of this thing will expire. Anyhow, and this is a SCORM generator. I'm not going to run through this, although you can look at this after. But the idea is the learning object authoring tool combines with the SCORM authoring tool. This is a beautiful little tool. It'll actually step you through the SCORM stuff. But if you combine them, a lot of the fields in the metadata can be filled automatically by the tool. And if you go back to the picture I was talking about earlier, it turns out all the metadata can be filled out automatically by the authoring tool. That is to say, all the first-person metadata. Second person, third person, now these are things that get added later, right? But to get the learning object off the ground, everything you need to get it into the system is created automatically by the system, by the software. So, you author, use a tool like this, not this obviously, because I can't share it, but a tool like this, it generates XML like that. You access the XSLT for free, royalty free from my website, because I authored that, so I can make that free. And you've got your learning object. You've got your metadata created. You're moving these things into the system. I'll probably, haven't planned on this firmly yet, but I'll probably talk this afternoon about DLORN and the mechanism for finding, sorting, feeding forward, all of that learning objects. There is a second stage to this, which is the whole distribution network. And it's not federated searching. It's something that actually works. So this is what I'm on about. We talk about, what was the topic of this talk? Knowledge, learning objects, and the new student. This is what this is about. When these things get talked to me, I think like this. I think these kind of things, rather than what you're probably usually seeing in the field of educational technology. It's a little underground, it's a little guerrilla, it's non-standard, it's small pieces, it's loosely joined, it's non-commercial, it's not something that is going to come down to you from above. It is the sort of thing that is going to be done by people working on their own without institutional support, because again, there's no money in this. All it is a good way to teach. And that's why I think in the end it'll be successful. So why don't we have our lunch break, and who knows what we'll talk about this afternoon. But thank you again for your time.
Thank you. I like that underground.